hello everyone, and welcome back to the Big Bang in Creationism podcast. This week, as I stated before, is going to be covering more of Richard Milton's book, which is Shattering the Myths of Darwinism. But first, I'd like to answer a question that was laid to me by an email, which has to do with the Big Bang and relativity and a movie. Fortunately, my listener was able to provide me with an audio file, so I'll play that first and then answer the questions.
Hi, my name is Axel, and I'm from Norway. I like your podcast, and I find it very interesting. Let me first tell you that it's pretty amazing to hear that creationists have such a big influence in your country. In Norway, there are very few creationists, and that the world was created 6,000 years ago is a ridiculous notion that almost no one believes. But there is a good many who think that the Big Bang theory is just as likely as anything else. Like God could create the universe just as easily. So my question for you is, how do you explain to a person the Big Bang theory in an easy way? Is there an easy way to explain it? Also, I didn't catch what relativity theory has got to do with the Big Bang. I was also wondering if you've seen the movie Donnie Darko. It involves time traveling and the problems with Christian schools not allowing the children to be taught different things. I also wonder if you understand how this movie ends, because it's a bit fuzzy. So, thank you. I love your podcast.
All right. Well, thank you, Axel, for providing the audio file. I'll do my best to answer the questions. First of all, explaining the Big Bang, if you want to explain it in a nice, easy manner, you can tell anyone who asks that it's a theory about the evolution of the universe, and I'd be sure to mention that when you say evolution, you don't mean biological evolution, you just mean change. Big Bang is a theory that describes the change of the universe from a very tiny, dense state to what it is today. And it will incorporate a large body of evidence that all testifies to its accuracy. One good example you could give would be the cosmic background radiation. The Big Bang, the hot Big Bang model, predicts that there's going to be this glow left over from basically the original singularity point. And we found this about 40 years ago. And so you can tell people who ask that there's evidence for the Big Bang all around us. And then you asked, what did relativity have to do with the Big Bang? Well, relativity actually has quite a lot to do with the Big Bang. What relativity does is it takes into account the gravitational effects on space-time from various massive objects like stars and galaxies, and it tells us then how the expansion of the universe is expected to continue over time. What we found today is that galaxies are actually accelerating in their expansion, and so something is overcoming the gravitational pull of the galaxies on each other and causing the universe to continue to accelerate outwards at an accelerating rate. And so this is what relativity has to do with the Big Bang. Relativity, remember, is a theory about space-time that depends on massive objects. And what we find when we take into account the pull of these massive objects on one another, we find that space-time still continues to expand, and as it expands, the gravity between the two gets weaker, based on the inverse square law by Newton. And when this gets weaker, we find that the expansion continues to grow faster and faster and faster. So for what we know now, thanks to relativity, is that the universe is going to continue to expand at an ever-accelerating rate, as far as we can tell. And then you asked about Donnie Darko. Well, I had never seen this movie, so I decided to rent it so I could answer your question. I have to say, that is one of the strangest movies I've ever seen. For those of you who haven't seen it, Donnie Darko is about a sleep-deprived teenager who talks to a bizarre guy in a rabbit mask who tells him the world is going to end. And then Donnie has to go do his bidding throughout the movie, and the ending is pretty strange. Now, the movie does try to talk a bit about time travel and wormholes, and it does mention what is known as the Einstein-Rosen Bridge. But on the whole, I have to say that the movie wasn't really scientific. It tried to be, and it might have looked that way to the layman, but it really wasn't that scientific. Now, they did talk about the Einstein-Rosen Bridge, as I mentioned, and what the Einstein-Rosen Bridge is essentially a bridge between two black holes. And this would connect two regions of space-time in either the same universe or a totally different universe, allowing quick travel from one place to the other. Now, the problem with using these to incorporate time travel like they did in the movie is that, as John Wheeler discovered in 1962, and just as a side note, John Wheeler was the one who named a black hole, essentially. The problem with using the Einstein-Rosen bridge is that they are so unstable that nothing could ever pass through it before the bridge collapsed. Again, as we talked about in the time travel episode, you need exotic matter to hold open wormholes, and this Einstein-Rosen bridge, as is currently formulated as we know how it is now, it's going to be so unstable that not even a single photon could pass through this bridge before it collapsed. So we couldn't really have Donnie Darko, say, flying through this wormhole going back in time, as he does in the film in the end. Sorry to spoil it for everyone. But that's what he does, and it really wouldn't be that way. It wouldn't be stable enough to allow him to travel through. And so that's how Donnie Darko is explained. It really doesn't make any sense scientifically, but it's an interesting movie, so if anyone wants to check it out, please do. So again, thank you, Axel, for providing me with that audio file. It really helped to kind of change up the podcast. Instead of having just me talking the whole time, we had someone else come on and talk. So again, thank you. And now we're going to move on into the creationist claims section for this week, which is going to be the radiometric dating claims made by Richard Milton in his book, Shattering the Myths of Darwinism. Now, last week I had stopped when I discussed a bit about the geologic column, and then I was just about to get into C14 or carbon-14 dating, but basically ran out of time and I hadn't looked at this section thoroughly enough so that I could give a full refutation of what Milton was saying, so I decided to stop there. So we're going to continue off with the C14 dating claims and move on to dendrochronology and then uranium-related dating before I end this week's podcast. So, when Richard Milton starts discussing C14 dating, first let me give a little bit of background on what C14 dating is. I know that I did that in a podcast a long time ago, but for those who are new and haven't really checked out that podcast, I just describe it in short again. Carbon dating is a method that utilizes the radioactive carbon, which is C14, to stable carbon. There's a ratio between the two, and it exists in every living creature. And when we take this ratio, we're able to provide accurate dates to organic objects that date back to about 50 to 60,000 years. For some reason, Milton only claims it's about 30,000 years, and he doesn't really give an explanation as to why. Now, one of the assumptions made in C14 dating is that the production of carbon-14 in the atmosphere has been relatively stable. If production rapidly outsourced decay or vice versa, the method wouldn't really be reliable. And it is this assumption that Milton decides to attack. Now, as Milton correctly states, in the formation of the Earth, it took some amount of time in order for an equilibrium to form between the production and the decay of C14. And once this equilibrium was created, the decay and the production of C14 should be about the same. So our proportion in all animals is therefore expected to be the same, and that's how the dating method works. They all take in the same ratio of C14 to C12. Once they die, they stop taking in both, and then the carbon-14, which is the radioactive stuff, decays, while the C12 doesn't. So as we get more and more C12 as compared to C14... we know we're getting an older creature, unless there's some kind of problem which we can detect. Now, Milton states, it is an assumption of uniformitarianism that the Earth is assumed to be older than this rate. That is, the rate of equilibrium. So, he's saying it's an assumption that the Earth is older than how long it took for the C14 and C12 to balance out. So he's saying if we see more production than decay, we could be in a state where we're trying to reach equilibrium still, and the Earth is some very tiny age, like, say, 30,000 years old, which is the one Milton decides to say. Now, Milton says in the 1960s, the decade which Milton seems to draw most of his papers from, it was found that there was a slight excess of production over decay of carbon-14. He cites a paper by a man named Richard Lingenfelter, and this paper was written in 1963. And indeed, in 1963, Lingenfelter stated that, at most, one excess atom of C14 was created per square centimeter per second, then decayed. Milton, again, neglects to mention some newer data and comes to the conclusion that the Earth is not yet out of this period where it's trying to reach the equilibrium between the two forms of carbon, and therefore concludes the Earth must be younger than 30,000 years old. Now, the data Milton didn't mention is a paper that came out 2 years later, in 1965, by a man named Stuvier. His paper, published in Science, was titled Carbon-14 Content of 18th and 19th Century Wood, Variations Correlated with Sunspot Activity. And it showed, as the title suggests, that the excess measured in the early 60s was the result of sunspot variation. What Milton has done is he's looked at a tiny portion of the years when C14 production was in excess and said it was the trend for the whole history of the Earth, when in reality the values fluctuated, and we can see this when we check the newer data. After Milton briefly covers carbon-14 dating and why he believes it's wrong, he moves on to attack another form of dating that doesn't actually have to do with radioactive isotopes. It is known as dendrochronology, which, as those of you who might be able to tell by the name, has to do with trees. Dendrochronology is the use of tree rings to be able to provide ages of objects. We use this method to date young objects. Furthest back we can go with this method is about 10,000 years. And it has also been used to check up on C14 dating to make sure it's accurate. The basis of this dating method is that every year there are trees that produce about one growth ring a year, and they do so throughout the entirety of their lives. And by counting up these rings, we can get exact ages for various objects. What Milton tries to do is he tries to raise doubts about the whole of dendrochronological dating by stating that, well, sometimes in very harsh seasons, growth rings might not form. And in certain latitudes, growth corresponds with moisture, while in others, temperature. Well, first of all, we take samples from multiple trees, so when we take our average, we filter out the individual variations, so that's not really a problem. And second, if scientists have been able to spot all of these variations, what would make Richard Milton think that scientists have not included these considerations into the work they do on dendrochronology? If they know about the possible problems and they know what to look for on the trees, what makes Milton believe that they don't even consider the fact, they don't even think about these different problems and they just go ahead and count the tree rings without considering these things? Scientists know about these, they're going to consider them, and they're going to give accurate dates using dendrochronology. And lastly, how come radiocarbon dating and dendrochronology agree so well about the dates of objects that they're able to test? Is it because they both get it wrong by just the right amount, just so they happen to give the exact same wrong date, or within a few years or a few hundred years if you get further back? Or is it perhaps because they're both accurate methods of dating? I leave it up to you to answer that. So moving on from dendrochronology, we go back to a method of radiocarbon dating. This is the dating related to uranium. To discuss dating related to uranium, Milton relies on a source, a man named Melvin Cook. Now, Cook is a creationist who Milton feels has been shunned by mainstream science because he has shown them the truth, that all radiometric dating methods are wrong, and science doesn't really want to accept that, and they want to continue believing in their falsified uniformitarianism view. At least that's what Milton thinks. Now, from a review I've read on the book itself, I guess I should get used to seeing Melvin as a reference, because apparently Milton uses him all of the time. Pretty much from here on, he will use Milton as a source, and eventually, according to the review at least, come to conclusions that Cook comes to, that is, that the Earth is very, very young. And yet we saw in the beginning of this book, he didn't claim to be a creationist, but we see him eventually starting to lean towards this creationist view that Cook brings into the story. Well, Cook brings a lot of claims in because Milton read a book of his, and so Milton kind of runs through these claims. And for the first claim he brings up, we have that if you date rocks, you're going to get the age of the Earth to be around 4.5 billion years old, the age that we normally get. However, if you date the atmosphere using this method, you get ages of only a few thousand years. So, how come we're getting these two different dates? I did a little research on what the atmospheric content of these various elements that are in the decay chain of uranium are. And, well, we don't really seem to have enough in the atmosphere to be able to date it, using uranium methods. I looked in the Handbook of Chemistry and Physics, and they say that at its highest reported value, uranium exists in about, and this is at most, 100 micrograms per cubic meter, or about 1/1,000,000th of a gram per meter. So, and this is not going to exist in some gaseous form, these are particulate pieces of matter that are going to be affected by gravity. And the abundance of the decay elements of uranium in the atmosphere are even worse. I didn't see anything about thorium-232, which is part of the decay chain, being in any measurable presence in the atmosphere, and lead having an abundance of 2 to 5 nanograms per square centimeter. Lead is not naturally in the atmosphere. It exists in the form of particles and naturally settles due to the pull of gravity, and rain will pull it down as well. So how Cook uses uranium-based dating to date the atmosphere is beyond me, and Milton doesn't really describe it in his book. I can try to find Cook's book, but I guess I can take a look at it, but I'm pretty sure he won't have any kind of way to describe how he was able to date the atmosphere using uranium-based dating methods. So the whole claim of dating the atmosphere using this method and getting some ridiculously small year is most likely because, well, there really isn't any type of uranium, thorium, or lead in the atmosphere, and most certainly there's none that's naturally in the atmosphere. Next, we see that Milton says scientists used potassium-argon dating, which is another form of radiometric dating that, of course, takes advantage of potassium and its decay product argon. And Milton stated that scientists who dated rocks from Mount Kilauea got ages of about several billion years, perhaps, I think he said 3 billion years, but the rocks were actually produced in 1801 in an eruption. Here he is trying to say that potassium-argon dating is incorrect because we've got these huge dates, but we actually know the rock was created in 1801. Remember, metamorphic rocks, the dates that are provided come from their most recent formation. So in 1801 is going to be their most recent formation. We should only detect these rocks to be about 200 years old, but we get them to be much older than that, 3 billion years off. So what exactly is the problem? Well, doing a bit of research, we find that Milton is misrepresenting what the scientists actually found. The dates that they came up with were not for the rocks that were formed during the eruption, but for the xenoliths jutting out of it. Now, what's a xenolith? A xenolith is a piece of rock that gets stuck in another rock when the latter rock forms. It's kind of like the xenoliths would be chocolate chips in a cookie. And so when the cookie forms, the chocolate chips were already there, we just stick them on. Of course, that's not how you exactly make a cookie, but that's as good of a description as I can provide right now. Now, these particular xenoliths in 1801, in this eruption, they carried a lot of excess argon, and that's how we yielded the older date. But the scientists who did this were sure to mention that the dates of the xenolith don't mean anything for the dates of the ages of the rocks in the Kilauea explosion. So the xenoliths, which are these other rocks that were older and got carried to the surface by the lava during an eruption, they are billions of years old. But these Kilauea rocks that were formed in the eruption themselves, they aren't billions of years old, and the xenoliths used, they do not pertain to it. They're two different rocks. The xenolith is one, and the rocks formed in the lava is another type. And so Milton's claim here is just based on misrepresentation of the data. And then Milton goes on to describe radiometric dating for about half a page, and he does a pretty accurate job of defining it. But then he continues to try to pick holes in the method. And again, he uses his pretty familiar phrase, which is, "Research in recent decades has begun to cast serious doubts on," and then he'll list what he thinks is serious doubts on. Now, his first problem is when he talks about the decay product of uranium-lead dating, which is lead-208. Again, he's going to use Melvin Cook as a source, and he claims that a process known as free neutron capture can lead to excess amounts of lead, yielding an older but inaccurate date. Now, Cook's reasoning is based on the fact that lead must have been produced by neutron capture because he sees there are two uranium deposits, but no thorium-232 exists, which is basically the in-between product of uranium and lead. And so with no thorium-232, he says the only way that this lead could get there is from lead-207 capturing free neutrons. Milton then goes on to state that Brent Dalrymple, I'm sorry if I butchered his name, but He says Brent has actually failed to provide an explanation to Cook's claim. Brent, for those of you who don't know, is a USGS geologist who attacks various creationist claims. And, well, Milton's saying right here that he can't answer Cook's claim on free neutron capture. And for those of you who don't quite understand neutron capture, these various isotopes of lead, lead 207, lead 208, they're based on the neutron count. And so when we add the free neutron that's captured by lead 207, we go up one, we get lead 208. So, and that's our radiogenic carbon. That's the decay product of thorium-232 as well. So with the free neutrons being captured, we get this view that we have a lot of decay product of uranium, but with free neutron, we really don't. It's just the capture of the neutron. It has nothing to do with the decay rate of uranium. Well, I want to take a look at Cook's claim, and first of all, this neutron capture that he provides, there's not enough for it to occur in any substantial amount to change the dating. And Cook seems to be aware of this. Dalrymple quoted him as saying that, well, I know there's this kind of lack of the amount of neutrons needed to provide this substantial date change, but there are a few examples of it happening, and so I think it could happen anywhere. Now, secondly, Cook didn't actually read the data correctly regarding the uranium deposits. The original source that provided the uranium source numbers for the amounts of uranium and lead and thorium in the deposits, the original source used dashed lines to indicate that there was no reading had been taken on various elements. So, for instance, with thorium-232, there were three dashed lines, and that meant that there was no reading. But Cook interpreted it as zero amount. So when he writes, there is no thorium-232 in these deposits, well, he didn't read it right. There is thorium-232, but we just didn't measure it. So, and the paper that Cook used as his source originally to say there's no thorium, it was clear to state that, and I quote, in 20 of the 21 samples investigated, the amount of common lead is so small that one need not take account of the variations in its composition. In a number of samples where the abundance of 204 lead was very low, no attempt was made to measure the amount of it, as the determination would be of no particular value. And for this lead as well, there are three dashes, and so we can conclude the same thing about thorium-232, that there was a value of thorium-232, just wasn't measured. Now, this information was attained by a paper written by none other than Brent Dalrymple. And so, when Milton states that Brent has been unable to provide an answer to Cook's claim, well, he hasn't been keeping up with the records. Well, this is all I'm going to discuss about Milton's book. There is a main reason why I'm stop reading it and stop making these claims until later. And that reason is because I don't have access to many of the scientific papers Milton uses when he discusses his claims. However, since I'm going to be going to college in a little over a month, I'll be able to gain access to basically all of these papers that Milton cites in his book. So I want to provide a more thorough refutation, and I want to look at the sources firsthand. Most of the stuff I've been seeing has been secondhand resources that quote the original. And while I don't really doubt the truth of it, I want to look at the papers myself and make sure I'm giving you the accurate information. So I'm going to stop reading Milton's book for now, wait until I get into college, look at the papers, and then provide a more thorough refutation of what he says. Now for those who are eagerly awaiting this podcast, I was hoping it would come out earlier. I apologize. Last week was pretty hectic for me. I was at home about maybe half the week. I went and registered for my first college courses about the 10th, and then I went to a friend's birthday party, and I was out of the house for two whole days. So, the episodes I know have been really irregular, and for that I apologize. I'll be trying to come out with them a little faster, and hopefully at college I can put the episodes on the internet myself without having to put them on a flash drive, given my father who takes them to Seattle and then puts them on there, because my internet won't allow me to place the files on the internet myself. So hopefully that'll be fixed. Now next week, I was thinking we'd have a bit of a pace change from refuting creationist claims nonstop. I wanted to do a review on Lisa Randall's book called Warped Passages. Now though I'm not yet all the way through it, and I know I've been reading it for months on end now, I understand the gist of the book and what it presents. If anyone has read it, feel free to send me your thoughts on it, and I'll make sure to mention them, but I just want to go over what the book talked about and what I thought of it. Well, for those of you who want to contact me, my email is rlippens, L-I-P-P-E-N-S, at wavecable.com. So feel free to send me your thoughts, comments, concerns, whatever you want to talk about. And if you want to visit the blog, it's lucretius1.blogspot.com. And there's a forum link there if you want to go talk on the forum. Again, there's only about one person who talks on the forum all the time, and there are a few people who come back and forth and talk a bit with her. But if you want to talk on the forums, feel free. We'd love to have you on there. All right, so the plan for next week, then, is going to be reviewing Lisa Randall's book, Warped Passages. Until then, have a great week, and we will talk next time.